folks. This is Jim French.
It's Ted Diamond.
And this is the Awareness Connection, a podcast where we talk about mind-body awareness, health, and human development. And today's episode is a continuation of the last episode where we were talking about the topic of developmental movement. Really rich, really interesting topic that fits right in to what we're discussing. We're going to see even more of that today. Yesterday, we touched on some of the history of the topic of developmental movement, its relationship to evolutionary theory, the relationship that a couple of different theorists had with evolutionary theory, some of the actual practice. And you can see it's, you know, it's a complex, rich topic, and there's a lot more to say about it. And so we're going to continue on that today. Ted, you and I were talking just before this about some of the things that you wanted to touch on in this particular episode. And I think that this is going to be a several episode series.
Yeah. Certainly a lot to say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the study of movement, I mean, when you look at infants progressing through the various stages in whatever way they do to arrive ultimately at, you know, in the toddler phase where they're walking on 2 feet, it's such a marvel, you know, wonderful journey that the child takes, and we all take pleasure in that. Any, you know, watching a child, you know, even just being able to raise their head and go up on their elbows at that very primitive stage where they're prone, or learning to crawl when they're trying to figure out the limb sequence, and then all of a sudden they're able to go forward, and then they become like little machines and start going around the room in such a vigorous, purposive way. It's beautiful to watch. And there's been such a kind of a rich history in studying how that happens.
Mm.
And I thought we should say a little bit about that, you know, okay. Because it's, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So literally like the, well, so do you want to talk about the different ways that that's been studied, or, do you want to talk about like the actual progression itself or both?
Yeah.
Or what?
No, I was thinking the way it's been studied just a little bit, you know?
Yeah. 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 Cause this has been approached in a lot of different ways. This is an old thing, you know, like, how do we view children? Are they ever really children? And all, you know, like, so some people think that, you know, you like become an adult at age 7, basically, and, you know, there's nothing more to say about it. And then we've got this, entire field where we're studying literally, the movements that infants put together before they can stand on 2 feet. Yeah. So like, yeah. How has it been approached, you know?
Yeah. Well, the first thing really that people did was just to observe it closely and identify these stages that emerge. And that was a really important phase in the study of infant development, because until then it really wasn't a science. It was sort of taken for granted. And so I think that's an important phase. And although some people recognize the role of environment, it was regarded as sort of those progressions were looked at simply as an outcome of a biological unfolding or biological clock, which I think is completely valid still, but they were criticized because they didn't take into account enough the environmental factors. And that has led to the current model that looks at the unfolding of stages in a child's development as being much more the outcome of a whole bunch of variables that have to be managed in order for a child to break through from one stage to another. So for instance, if a child is not able to crawl, it might have something to do with their clothing or their weight or the environment that they're in, so that you can't just say that the ability to crawl is simply internally driven. It's related to the infant's relationship to the external environment.
Mm.
And that's led to this current model that looks at development as a set of variables. And the problem with that is that although that's interesting and gives us a certain, I don't know, insight into the child, the relationship of the growing, maturing infant to other factors, it doesn't explain very much about how the child actually functions. In fact, from that point of view, it's almost empty. And I think of this as a little bit like how you'd look at a car. You know, if you looked at a car which is moved by an engine, that's a little bit like an infant that has sort of a motor system that's sort of the engine of movement. But if you said, yeah, but the car is not just about the engine, it's also about the road and the conditions and the driver. Now you'd have a more robust theory that would take into a lot of other, you know, take into account a lot of other factors.
Yeah.
The problem is that if you now looked at the performance of the car in terms of all those factors, that would be useful. Certainly, if you're trying to get the best out of a car's performance, you'd say, well, I got to take into account the tires and the road and other things.
Yeah.
But it begs the question how the engine works. And the truth is that a lot of the developmental theory, they have very little, the researchers have very little actual insight into the nature of the child's ability to move. And the study of developmental movement, really, to be meaningful, has to be all about that.
Yeah.
In fact, I even wonder sometimes, James, whether, you know, the researchers ever get on their hands and knees to think about and look at how you actually crawl and what that's like, and to actually themselves experience these infantile stages, you know. And developmental movement is really all about that. Get on your hands and knees and, you know, look at how you do these things.
So you're saying that this is a subject that I'm obviously not super familiar with, the modern conception of child development. I've heard the names, I've heard you speaking about them. And so these, you know, for instance, you were critical of the notion of the variables. Could you say more about what you mean by what they mean by variables?
Well, one variable is the weight of the child. So an infant learning to crawl is going to be influenced by the fact that he or she might be wearing a diaper, that their legs are heavy, they're also influenced by, you know, for that matter, you know, mood and other, you know, level of sleep, et cetera.
But yeah.
Those variables affect the emergence of the child's ability to actually perform a movement. So that now you look at the emergence of crawling as a result of these variables coming together.
Yeah.
This is the work of, the theory I'm speaking about is Esther Thalen. It's sort of a dynamic systems model. And she says that when the variables come together, then you get a sudden phase shift.
Okay.
Where all of a sudden the child's able to crawl.
Yeah.
But the ability to crawl is still internally driven in some level by reflexes that are present.
Mm-hmm.
And to study developmental movement as a meaningful, practical discipline, you have to look at what's actually going on.
Mm.
You know, so for us as adults, if you get on all fours, on hands and knees, or elbows and knees, already, the fact that you can get on all fours is possible because postural muscles automatically come into gear to support you. And that's always present, even in our most, you know, mature, adult, upright state.
Mm.
Those postural muscles are working, for better or worse, all the time. And to be able to crawl, you want to be able to have that support and not interfere with it, to be able to crawl effectively. And most adults can't do that.
I see.
So the study of developmental movement requires a model of function that looks at the actual engine, the actual machinery, and how it works.
All right. Okay. Yeah, so you're not in danger of saying, like, say Thalen's theory, dynamical systems theory, accounts for purely external variables, and we want to look at internal variables. You're saying that, like, it's not really like that. You know, like, the criticism is more like like you said about the car, it's necessary to study the child's motor system, which would be postural reflexes, which would be contractile tissue and bones and their relationships. You know, you can't really say independently of the child's, you know, weight or their clothing or external, like, environmental situation, but, like, you know, you need to be studying the relative state of function of the child's own motor system.
Yeah.
And if you don't have an understanding of that, or if you leave that out, then there's an emptiness at the core of this theory.
Yeah. And that core, to me, is the thing that really impels the theory forward. Mm. So in the study of developmental movement, there are people who say, well, the real key to developmental movement is to look at the phases that the child makes, to observe how they happen. And then if an adult is having a problem, mm-hmm. go back to those phases and have them go through them again, because perhaps mm-hmm. they short-circuited them. But this is a romantic conception that somehow, if we just go back to the phases and sort of recapitulate them,
yeah,
that will have that will rewire the brain,
yeah,
that will come out functioning normally again or functioning better.
And yeah, they have, like, an integrating effect.
Yeah, and the corollary of that theory is that is a sort of what I would describe as a kind of a false concept of aims and purposes, which is that if you do that, you're going to be somehow more mature or more realized or more open. And it's just not that simple. And it's not, that's just not clear about what the purpose of the process even is. The purpose of the process is to actually become better coordinated and more aware in what we're doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah. I just think it's important to mention that, because I don't think that the whole subject can be made sense of until you have a better working idea of how movement actually takes place.
Yeah, so, like, you're not only saying that you know, the function of the motor system, broadly put, the bones, the muscles, you know, the reflexes and all this, the function of the motor system needs to be studied. You're also saying that, unlike previous conceptions, it's not invariable. There's no specific, there's no unchanging biological clock. There's no unchanging motor system. You're saying that this can function well, this can malfunction, this can be, like, interfered with. So you're broadening this, you know, you're complexifying the study of the motor system.
Yeah.
You're also saying, okay, well, you know, there's like, let's not, in criticizing the notion of an invariable, let's take it for granted motor system, let's not be reactionary and say, well, you know, the only thing that matters are external variables or even internal variables. I don't know. Sometimes it seems like the Thalen theory is like a reaction to those earlier conceptions.
Yeah, totally. In my view, it's completely a reaction, and it gets traction, because once you show that the previous model is wrong, then everyone credits you for having some, you know, breakthrough understanding. But where's the understanding? When you when you now have taken into account several variables and not just, let's say, the internal biological clock variable, now you have an interesting way of looking at things. You've definitely shown that there were limitations in the previous model, but what have you done to enlighten the field? You know, what you do now, what they'll say is that the variables explain movement, but the variables, when you when you take into account variables, it's a little bit like the car analogy. If you now say that the performance of the car is related to the road and the tires and other variables and the wind, et cetera, you do understand something more about the performance of the car, but you don't understand much about the car itself.
Mm-hmm.
And if you now use those variables to say, now that's how the car works, what you've done is you've elevated an abstract, you know, setup, an abstract concept to a category of explanation that it can't match, it can't meet.
Mm.
So I'm saying we got to go back to the child and say, what actually goes into crawling? Can we articulate how it works? Can we see how it gets interfered with? And can we use that study to understand it better? Because it can be looked at in a very practical way.
Mm.
So if you're crawling in such a way that you're arching your back and stiffening your legs, you're interfering with crawling.
Mm.
And if you're able to bring about a better working of the system and now can identify when and how you interfere, now you've got a real working model of developmental movement as a way of actually gaining greater understanding of motor function at that level, which will inform our understanding of how we stand and sit and do other actions. And yeah. To my mind, that's a real kind of science of awareness. So developmental movement actually gives us a way of looking at the science of how we gives us a kind of science of self-study, of movement.
Yeah, and so that's the other thing, where you're reincorporating the study of the infant and the person within a context of external reality. You know, you're recentering it, but you're also refocusing the goals of developmental movement, the goals of the study of this, and taking it away from these sort of vague maturational conceptions, these vague sort of psychologizing perspectives, where maybe people were trying to recapitulate like early cognitive development frameworks. You know, it makes me think of Piaget and these guys, who I have a lot of respect for, but, you're refocusing this on the study of action, on movement, of how we are in space. You know, so what, you know, you're respecifying goals here.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. Because I think when a field has not clarified what the problems are, it will come up with it'll fill in the gaps with kind of fabricated goals.
Mm.
You see it with stress theory, you know. If you know how to lower stress, then you take the weight of the world off your shoulders. So now you're emotionally lighter. So now they say, well, that's mind body unity. You know, stress puts weight on your shoulder, and if you're able to use less tension when you do something, that's lowering stress and other weight. So it's sort of an vague emotional benefit.
Yeah.
That's an example of where if you said to someone, well, what is the aim and purpose of, you know, understanding stress? You say, well, it's an emotional unburdening. That's not, yeah. There's so much more to say about stress and the possibility of, you know, what it means to lower stress. Anyway, it's a little bit like that here. We've got the wrong kind of model about what's at stake.
Yeah. Yeah. The wrong model about what's at stake, you know, the wrong sort of like, you know, almost like too, you know, like one theory that was too stable and too reliant on like an unchanging internal system. The other that was a reaction to that. So it made it all about the external variability. And then like a practical, an actual practice, like a therapeutic practice based on both of those, which was unclear in its goals, which came up with vague or fabricated or pseudoscientific outcomes.
Yeah, exactly. And Yeah, what I needed, my own interest in this was driven by my own personal interest and need. I wanted to understand more about how I could actually function better.
Yeah.
I found the idea of sort of go, recapitulating these phases of movement and getting some immediate experience or benefit, I found that to be too limiting. I thought there's something more here, and there is.
Yeah. So like just, function better. Like, you came with a back problem, or you came with like technical problems at the piano. Performance difficulties in say like the playing of a guitar or vocalizing. The performance of everyday actions, which would lead to like lack of vitality or pain or muscular dysfunction and all this, you know?
That's really, to my mind, the real area that we're looking at. And again, as I mentioned, the last time we spoke about this, that's not, some people say that's not very sexy. They don't want it to be about that because they think, just doing actions better. How does that help me? That's not, that's not helping me to, I don't know, see into the real meaning of the, but that's the real meat of the subject that has to be looked at.
Yeah, that's the real meat, and that's what deserves attention. And it's only someone's like misconceptions or their lack of experience or imagination that tells them that this is unsexy, that this is boring. You know, it's like wait till you get into it. It's so interesting.
So if, yeah, incredibly interesting.
You know, it's like trying to convince someone that this album is going to be great, or this movie is going to be great. I'm not going to like it. You know, I saw the trailer. It looks like shit. So,
So you mentioned the last time, James, about primitive postures, and that's a big part, I think, of the real practical significance of developmental movement is if you're looking at the motor system and how it works, and you're actually looking at the practical reality of this system, one of the things you could see in infants before, well, when they're doing these movements often very, very efficiently and beautifully, is that they have natural reflex support. So an infant that's first going up on all fours and then is beginning to rock back and forth before they're able to coordinate forward movement in space, one of the interesting things about that movement is how strong and natural it is for them to do that, because they're not voluntarily extending their arms. When they go up in their arms, that's happening a little bit like you described a horse, a foal. When born and they go up on their limbs, it's instinctive, it's happening, they're sort of unsteady, but they're able to extend the limbs very powerfully. And when you see that happening, you realize that there's some basic postural function that's operating that we tend to lose, because you ask the average, I think of a 40-year-old guy, a strong 40-year-old guy to crawl, and they don't do it powerfully the way a child does. They do it with too much muscle tension and stiffening. So typically, an adult male, when crawling on all fours, will just be muscular, like the whole thing's like a push-up. That's not skillful. That's really unskillful. So assuming that posture, or even more primitive ones, just like lying on your belly, is a very good way of reorganizing and reminding the system that those big powerful muscles that do a push-up are not needed to go on all fours. And deeper postural tissues are required and helping to stimulate that. So we use these primitive postures to remind and reorganize the muscular system to go back to this much more efficient way of supporting, so that we could begin to define what needs to happen and what definitely doesn't need to happen to perform simple movements. And that's the beauty of doing all these very primitive phases of movement.
That's really cool. Like, what you said about the foal, realizing that the foal, their I don't know, their consciousness, their intelligence, or whatever it is, they're managing something automatic. You know, they're standing up, but you know, like you said, not like a 45-year-old guy who weightlifts. You know, they're not like getting in there and being like Sylvester Stallone in Rambo, like boom, getting up there. Their legs are extending as part of like this sort of automatic muscular process, this sort of automatic tensegrity process, really, like this stretch process, this firing off of contractile tissue in order to make the membrane stretchy and flexible and strong. And they're learning how to manage this almost, you know, like in real, you know, you can see them do it. And the same thing with an infant. I don't know, it just makes me think that like the, you know, like the dynamical systems theory could be really interesting. It could be really interestingly integrated into like learning, you know, like how does a child or like how does an animal learn how to manage something that is an automatic process, something that is like an internally automatic process. And then of course, you know, this is the practice here as adults, as adult humans who can learn. How do we learn to restore, just like you said, automatic postural function so that we're sort of witnessing it happen and we're realizing that like our normal way of doing things is literally just to interfere with that function. We're not trying to do it in a more relaxed manner or a more soft manner or something like this. We're literally trying to restore an automatic, very strong, robust system and learn how to manage it in everyday actions consciously.
Yeah, and to restore it and then figure out what we do that has interfered with it all along, you know. And that's the semi-supine posture. I mean, one of the most useful ways of restoring it is to lie in this case supine, which is a very primitive, you know, like prone, a very primitive posture, but a kind of a modified primitive posture for adults, because most adults cannot lie supine in a way that's helpful. Head will be thrown back, the back will arch. So we get the knees up, the head supported on books to put length on the whole system. And so it's a modified primitive posture that helps restore the postural system, but it is in fact not just some sort of remedial process. It is in fact an infantile posture. So it's a very good example of developmental movement. We don't often think of it that way when you put someone in that position and say, I want to put you in this position so that you're not pulling your head back, so your spine can lengthen, your back muscles can let go, and you could begin to experience how the postural system can work normally. We're not just giving them something remedial. We're actually beginning an educational process of going back to a very infantile movement, because in that position, we're helped along in a way that standing wouldn't help us. Most people standing, you can't get that to happen. So it's a big, you know, part of developmental movement is going back to the more primitive, you know.
And studying, like return. Well, okay. Well, this actually leads me to a question then. How do we identify helpful postures? You know, like how do we identify developmentally primitive postures? Do we look at an infant and see just what they're doing? Is that how these were identified?
Well, I think some of the developmental methods have done that, but I'm not so sure that that's the best way. Certainly, it's limited, because if you look at what kids do and say, "Oh, wow, look at how wonderfully that child lies on his or her back," and then rolls over, and then you try that with an adult, they're not going to do it so well. Or crawling. You know, you look at a child when the ch when children crawl, it's so beautiful and efficient and you know, powerful and effortless at the same time, that you think, well, all I got to do is get on all fours and I could do the same thing. The truth is that most people crawl quite badly, and if you get them doing it, sometimes they do more harm than good. Their wrists hurt, they can't do it very long, they're using too much muscle. But you can learn from watching how they do it. And you can, again, you have to modify what you're doing. I think sitting is a wonderful position, used properly, sitting is like semi-supine position because it's a way of getting, when you're sitting, your, you know, your femurs are at a right angle to the body. Yeah. It tends to reduce the curves of the lower back. It, again, used properly, it's a way of reestablishing length in the system. So it's a very useful kind of posture.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. It's position. We're searching for positions that give us advantage in learning to restore the postural system.
Yeah.
And yeah. I think crawling is one of them, but it needs a little help. So okay. If you get someone crawling on all fours, you have to show them a little bit about how the system is organized so that they can approach that constructively.
Well, so how do we know then? Like, how do we identify positions that are, you know, that like provide that sort of advantage?
Well, I think James, this is why the field why you can't approach developmental movement in the romantic way of just going back to childhood and just recapitulating. Mm-hmm. I remember once I met a woman who was learning a whole series of developmental movements, and she went through it every morning for 45 minutes or an hour. And yeah. She came to me for lessons, and I asked her to show me. And I mean, after 5 minutes, she was sweating. She was working out. It was like a workout, but she was in a complete state. I mean, arching her back, yanking her head back. But she was so convinced that this was good for her that she just was sort of ignoring the reality of how aggressively she was just simply trying to do these movements.
Mm-hmm.
To really make sense of developmental movement, we have to have a working theory about how the system works that we bring to the process, which is why the field has been sort of held back by, you know, this romantic idea that you could somehow just go back to childhood in this infantile states and just go through them better, and why it needs a theory. And this is why it's taken me so long just to write about this and to write a coherent theory, is because I've realized that to look at it, you need starting knowledge. And I think Alexander created that, began to give us that starting knowledge.
All right. Yeah. You know, because when you say the system, you know, like knowledge of how the system works, you mean like knowledge of how the motor system works, how the postural mechanism works, the organization of body parts, relatively speaking, that whole subject.
Exactly. So it's really, it's the PNR system. So it's really, and then I define that whole subject as sensory motor awareness, because it needs a whole curriculum and a fully fleshed out theory.
Mm-hmm.
So developmental movement to be made sense of, you really need a sort of an overarching theory, which we have not had. I mean, I don't believe that searching, observing the stages an infant goes through, and then sort of idealizing that and romanticizing it and saying, well, now we're going to go through those stages and get these benefits. That to me is not a theory.
Mm.
That to me is a kind of a practice with a kind of a curtailed theory or limited theory.
Yeah.
The theory has to explain a little bit about how movement is actually designed to take place and progresses from those more primitive to more, complex systems.
I see. And that's, that's, to return to your car analogy, it's going to require, really a return to the study of the car. It's going to require a study of how the car functions, how it's designed to function. It's sort of like design specs and how it malfunctions, which is something that you can study as well. You can study like how the thing malfunctions, because its malfunction is going to be its malfunctioning is going to be a function of its design. it's going to be related to how the thing is designed in the first
place. Exactly. Absolutely. You know? Absolutely. So now we're talking about the car, if it's not actually running well, you've got to know how the engine works. You've got to know what's gone wrong with it. And of course, to understand what goes wrong with an engine, you have to understand the concept of the engine as a positive functioning system.
Yeah.
We haven't had that with the human being. And of course, that's part of our existential, kind of, I don't know.
Thrownness,
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. Exactly. Yeah. This is where we are, where we find ourselves in our human state. Here we are trying to figure out how we function. It's a big proposition.
Mm-hmm.
I have parts of it, I think, that I've gotten clear on. I think that there needs to be much more work in the field to understand fully how all those reflexes combine from early childhood and into the upright state. If I had a doctoral student who wanted to go into a deep study of that, that would be wonderful. I think no one's done that yet.
Mm-hmm.
But a basic understanding of how our upright system works and the relation of muscle, bone, connective tissue, the nervous system that makes it possible for that system to work, that's sort of the equivalent of having a basic working knowledge of the internal combustion engine. And say, that's how the car moves.
Yeah.
So that now when it's not working well, we could see what's going wrong. We can actually rectify it, get it working well, but at a more conscious level. And that's part of the beauty of the subject is that we're able, by using the primitive phases and movement and postures and studying them from the point of view of that working knowledge, we can now not only restore the system, but get it working at a more conscious level. So it becomes not a therapeutic process or an emotionally enlightening, it becomes a truly educational discipline leading to heightened awareness in living.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So there's more to say, James. So I wanted to just point it out that there's more to say about how that whole thing, works and evolves. I think it's just sort of an interesting.
Yeah. Well, it's just amazing because the subject of developmental movement itself is so rich that we've spent two episodes talking about where it comes from, where it belongs. But the subject, like the broader project that you're working on, is how does developmental movement, what is it really? What are its goals? How has it been used? Further is where does it belong within the study of motor function? Not only how the child develops, but how the musculoskeletal system, how the movement system itself functions, how it malfunctions. Developmental movement redefined and reclarified belongs in sensory motor awareness. It's like fully a part of sensory motor awareness, which is, the field that was the subject that was kind of discovered or inaugurated by F.M. Alexander. Yeah. So this is a really interesting project.
Yeah.
There's just so much to say.
Yeah. And I wonder if we should do a third podcast on this just to discuss some of those elements.
I think so too. I think it would be really cool because, we've touched a lot on, broad contextual issues last time. We've talked about the recent intellectual history, especially, the dynamical systems view, the Thalen this time, with some criticisms of it. And we've touched on practical elements, you've talked about positions and what they're used for. And we've also touched on why would you use them? Because it's really about understanding how the function of the musculoskeletal system is and redefining goals. So I think that we can spend another episode talking about practical issues, what do you do? How do you practice this? What does it take? What are some of the skills that you learn and what are the skills that you have to take into it?
Yeah. I like that. I'm jotting a couple of these thoughts down for us to follow up. Yeah, I
Yeah.
agree. Let's do that. I think we should do a third talk on this and cover some of those very things.
Think so too. Well,
Yeah.
so
Okay.
that's a perfect place to wrap it up for today then. So, thanks again for the conversation. Always appreciate it.
Thank you, James.
Yeah, thank you everybody for tuning in.
Thank you all.
This has been the Awareness Connection. Find us on your favorite platform, like and subscribe. Thank you.